and welcome to this thing that we call Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, episode 27, Abbott and Costello in the Foreign Legion. And now, la plume de maton est sur le bureau de mon oncle, which loosely translated means, here's Nick Santa Maria.
I know quite a few loose French people.
Yes.
in fact, one of them is named Toulouse.
Latrec.
He's very short.
Yes.
Very, very short. You know, it's funny because you imagine a short person like Toulouse Latrec, there would only be the bottom of the canvas that's painted. You know what I mean? He's not tall. He's not a tall person. But anyway, not many painters looked up to him. Let's talk about things.
Yes.
Jerry, I just have to know.
Yes.
How you doing?
Well, since you have to know,
I suppose
I have to tell you. Doing well.
We don't do things by halves. Yes.
No. Yes, I'm doing well. As I have shared with you, and I think I mentioned on our last episode, I'm in the middle of some theater projects right now, directing some one-act plays at our local theater. And as can often be the case, you know, one of them is just a dream and the other is a nightmare.
Well, there you go. You've got your contrast right there, which is always good in theater.
You know? It is. It really is.
I think so.
Yeah.
My writing partner, the guy who wrote my musical with me, Real Men, the musical.
Yes.
He sent me one of my songs done by AI.
Oh.
Now, he didn't tell me it was AI. He just sent it to me. And there was this jazzy sort of voice with a jazzy piano and drums and bass doing this song. And I'm thinking, who recorded this song without getting my permission, for one thing, you know?
Yeah.
And it turns out it was AI. He says there's this thing where you press the microphone icon and you sing the song into your computer and it comes back fully arranged and sung.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a little scary.
That's a lot scary. I'm sorry. That's
But wow. Again, I'm flirting with it. It's fun. You know, I do have Chat GPT and it really is a lot of fun. Okay, so we are talking about, speaking of a lot of fun.
Yeah.
We are talking about a film made it is their first film in the 1950s. It is 1950s Abbott and Costello in the Foreign Legion. Now, in the last episode of our podcast, I mentioned that the title seems to be only Foreign Legion. And I was basing that on the one title card that comes on. But this is what happens. And Jerry and I were discussing this earlier. A title card comes on, Bud Abbott and Lou Costello in the. That's the title card. And then, boom, Foreign Legion comes up all alone. So I looked it up and I started looking at other resources and every single one calls it Abbott and Costello in the Foreign Legion. That started me thinking, you know, why would they just call it Foreign Legion? You know, it's not a castle film. It's, you know, it's a full length film, you know, almost, you know, with a $735,000 budget. So it's a little bit more hefty than that. So yeah, so that's the title. And interesting stuff about the title. If you have our book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello by Matthew Conium and myself, Matthew wrote the chapter on this movie. Mm-hmm. And he brings up something that, well, let's put it this way. He's not as fond as the later movies as I am. I enjoy them for what they are. I know they're not, you know, Buck Privates and they're not, you know, Hit the Ice and whatever. He claims, and quite rightfully so, he claims that the edge Abbott and Costello had over the other comedy teams, and he names them, I won't. He says the edge they had over them is that their characters were not only in the film, which is a very prescient, up-to-the-minute modern story in a modern setting, mm-hmm. but they would stop to do their burlesque routines along the way. It was what made them so successful. But then as the trends changed after the war, people were demanding a bit more. They wanted more story, more situations, you know, less frivolity. Let's put it that way. And, you know, for whatever reason, that happened. And you either like it or you don't, or, you know, or you like both, like me. I find the joy in their early films to be, you know, just wonderful. They're just wonderful, carefree, great, got everyone through World War II. But it was over in 1945. They started making different kinds of movies. And, you know, I'm sorry, but I like them. I like them. I like this movie. You know, Jerry, it's not one of their greats, but I watched it last night and, you know, it made me think back to when I was a kid. I was never disappointed when this one came on. I enjoy it as I watch it. And the boys are on, you know, they're on. They have a great supporting cast. You know, you seldom get villains like that, you know. And there are three of them in this one.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll get to that. Okay, now I wanted to bring up another subject that's a little bit more sensitive. And I know there are a lot of people out there, for some reason, no offense to anyone, but who find Bud funnier than Lou, which is, to me, is just inconceivable. But still, there's something going on now. As they are facing television, it's a whole new medium. They're back in front of live audiences. To do an hour-long live show in the early 1950s was like Sisyphus. It was like pushing that rock up the hill. It was tough going. And you see it. You see it in Lou, especially. He's sweating and he's working himself to death. Bud disappears every so often. He just, you know, all right, you do this and I'll go backstage and, you know, whatever. He just disappears more and more frequently, not only on the TV shows, but in the films themselves. Now, why? Matthew says, and I wanted to read this to you because he puts it very well. And a lot of people give Lou a lot of sorus because, you know, they're assuming, oh, no, he's the one who pushed him out and blah, blah. No, he didn't. This is what happened. When Lou does a routine with Patricia Medina about, you know, we and us and all of that, that John Grant wordplay, Bud ducks out entirely and leaves the moment to Lou and Patricia Medina. In their very small way, these moments underline another new trend in their work that is worth stopping and considering in detail, namely the way that such exchanges are increasingly played by Lou and a supporting character rather than Lou and Bud. We know that as a combination of his epilepsy and the drinking he used to alleviate it, Bud began to decline as a performer in the 50s. His body thickened, his delivery slowed, and his voice became raspy and coarse. Often in their live TV shows, we sense he is only semi-present. Perhaps this decline begins earlier, was more obvious to those in the know than it seems to us, and may help explain something that can seem hard to understand about their later career, namely the manner in which Bud comes increasingly to take a back seat as a performer. Note how the decision to unteam them in Little Giant and The Time of Their Lives just happens to have the main effect of letting Bud out of the crosstalk. We are accustomed to thinking of this as purely the result of a row over the hiring and firing of their domestic staff, but it should be pretty obvious to all that to trigger so decisive a change in their working methods, so petty a squabble just had to be symbolic straw breaking of a much larger camel's back. And I have to wonder if professional frustrations didn't quite rationally inform the decision, too. Certainly, the idea that Bud was relegated to smaller roles so Lou could shine in those pictures is simply not true. He has two roles in Little Giant and a very good comic part in The Time of Their Lives. This is not Lou being an SOB, and it might even be Lou looking out for his pal. Nick's chapters have noted the increasing emergence of Sidney Fields as crosstalk stand-in for Bud. This will continue on television. Notice how often in their live TV appearances, Bud and Lou come on together, and then the sketch involves Bud going off and leaving Lou to it in what is essentially a solo. Or if he does stay, real effort is put into taking the heat off him. In perhaps the last of their quintessential routines, the body rub skin treatment, Bud spends the entire sketch asleep. And of course, the major change in the relative quantities of physical slapstick and wordplay in their films, visible here, fits into the same mosaic. Back in Buck Private's, logic was happily suspended in the drill scene to keep Bud at the heart of the action. Why would a new recruit be left in charge of drilling the others? Because otherwise it ain't a Bud and Lou routine. Now, increasingly, excuses are found to let him pass. It is feasible to speculate, I think, that Bud's problems with maintaining the punishing pace and split-second recall necessitated by their methods of working began rather earlier than we may have supposed, and represented a challenge to the team's dynamic and a problem to be negotiated from then on. I think that's really well put.
Yes.
And, you know, and we've mentioned it a few times that Bud sort of disappears. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go out and look for a job for you. You stay here and do 10 routines with other actors. That's a reality. And it's nothing that Lou did to Bud. Bud was 9 years older. He was practically a full decade older than Lou. Mm-hmm. What they did was very physically challenging. Slapstick comedy is so much harder than it looks. Trust me. So poor Bud, you know, he had to keep up. And sometimes he couldn't, and that was the case. So Charles Lamont is back. He's in the director's chair. Charlie Barton decided that he was going to work with a mule rather than Lou. So he went off to direct. Did he do any of the Francis movies? I guess. I don't know. But he was getting a little tired of being the Abbott and Costello director. And he loved the boys. He was friends with both of them. But, you know, he was tired of the pies and the card games and, you know, all of that. So they looked at comedy veteran Eddie Sedgwick. Edward Sedgwick, part of a famous vaudeville family. He was a director, and he worked with Keaton quite a bit. And Joey Brown, he did a lot of his movies. Did Laurel and Hardy in Air Raid Wardens, but we'll forgive him for that. And so he was considered for this movie, but Universal eventually said, you know what? He takes too long, and we're Universal. So we want fast, cheap, and fast, like most of my wives. So I hope they're listening. So who did they turn to? They went to Charlie Lamont. Now, Charles Lamont, after directing Hit the Ice, what was that, 7 years earlier? He said, I don't want to be pegged as an Abbott and Costello director. Thank you very much. So he went off onto other things. And then they offered him a 7-year contract later on, and he said, bring on those Abbott and Costello movies. He realized, this is my future. So he ended up directing, I think, 7 more.
Yeah.
At this point, he became their final director at Universal, and a good choice because not only was he a comedy veteran, he worked fast. In fact, this movie, he brought it in a week under schedule and $56,000 under budget.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what Charlie Lamont was famous for. So they loved him, and Bud and Lou got along very well with him. So anyway, here's what poor Lou was dealing with at this point. They had been gone from the screen for a full year. After they did their previous film, Meet the Killer, Lou fell down with another bout of rheumatic fever, kept him in bed for 4 or 5 months. Eventually, as he was coming out of it, he had a gangrene on his gallbladder, and that had to be removed. And that was in November of 1949. They were going to shoot this movie in December of 49, but because of Lou's illnesses, they had to push it up. So Lou is giving interviews in January of 1950 saying, I'm fine, I'm done, that's it. I almost died twice, and I didn't. Yet Universal, as soon as they heard Lou was sick, put them on suspension, meaning they cut out all money, you know, you're on your own until you're ready to work again. And Lou in January saying, I'm ready. Why are they keeping us off? I can't believe this. We are the top money makers here for 10 years. We've kept the studio in the black. We are now in the top 3 box office behind Hope and Crosby. And the interviewer asked, does that matter to the studio? And Lou said, no, not at all. They don't listen to us at all. I don't know what this next movie is about. I've been asking for better films, Technicolor, this and that. They don't listen to me. And this is coming from the person or one of the people that is supporting the studio.
So I
don't know. Sorry, guys, but every time I hear that Lou is difficult with the studio heads, I'm behind him going, go Lou, go Lou, go Lou, because he was right. So finally, around April, the studio said, okay, let's do the movie. This is a full year later. Mm-hmm. So they make Foreign Legion, Abbott and Costello in the Foreign Legion. By the way, If you remember in our last episode, we talked about how the Lou Costello Jr. Foundation was under a mortgage for $80,000, which the boys did not have. They already contributed $250,000, which I don't even want to tell you what that is in today's money. Mm-hmm. And this was out of their own pockets. So they actually did put up that charity fight, a lightweight championship fight. And you know how much they made? $86,000. And it all went to the foundation.
Nice.
Yeah, it was nice. But the problem was Lou was so sick, he couldn't do any personal appearances in 1949. Mm-hmm. So they couldn't raise any money. And of course, LA didn't help them. The studio didn't help them. So Lou finally bit the bullet and offered it to the city, who picked it up. And now they run it to this very day. So you've still got the beautiful painting of Butch in the lobby when you walk in, and it's still named after him. So thank you, Los Angeles, at least for that. So Lou was going in ready. He was loaded for bear, you know? It was like, let's go, for crying out loud. He looks great in the movie. He's at a good weight and everything. Yeah. And Bud, too. Bud's mm-hmm. not mustache Bud yet, and I think he looks great, too. When they come on with their white suits and stuff, they look, they really look sharp. So the writers, let's go there. D.D. Beecham, the guy who originally came up with The Wistful Widow of Wagon Gap, one of my favorite Abbott and Costello movies.
Yeah.
He came up with this idea. I can imagine him sitting there and suddenly sitting straight up and saying, Foreign Legion. Yes, what an idea. A Foreign Legion. Sand dunes and camels and, you know, harems. And anyway, I hate to tell him, but Laurel and Hardy did it twice in the 1930s.
Yes.
1932's Bo Hunks, which is a double entendre. Not many people know this. Mm-hmm. It's a spoof on Bo Jest, of course. But Bo Hunks is another way of saying Hungarians. Mm-hmm. It's like a derogatory term for Hungarians. You're a bohunk. And so I don't know why that came up, because it just sounded right, I guess. And then 7 years later, in 1939, they made The Flying Deuces, where they also mistakenly joined the Foreign Legion.
Yeah.
And I only recently, this year, figured out the title, The Flying Deuces. Oh,
really?
Just this year. Seriously, because I look at it, I take it as face value, and that's what it is. The product is the Flying Deuces. Then I started thinking, why the Flying Deuces? Oh, Flying Aces. It's a stupid pun and a dumb title. and a mediocre film, actually. It's okay. It's got its moments. anyway, so D.D. Beecham came up with that brilliant idea. And this movie also, it's got traces of Road to Morocco, you know, those two Laurel and Hardy movies that I mentioned, Mummy's Boys with Wheeler and Woolsey.
Yep.
So, the desert thing has been pretty much done to death. And then they got their new radio writers, who we talked about earlier, Leonard Stern and Martin Ragaway. And these guys were the writers on their new radio show for ABC, which was a pretty much new, struggling network, but they had Bing Crosby as their key talent, and it eventually shot through the roof. Now, Stern and Ragaway, I love, because I've talked about this, the radio show is different. There's very few crosstalk old routines. It's all new stuff, and they invented Sam Shovel, who we talked about. Lou wanted a whole show based on Sam Shovel. And if you haven't heard that, go on YouTube. They're all there. It's very funny stuff. Okay, so those are the writers on this one. So everything is moving along. And we have opening titles. Remember the last movie we talked about how cheap they looked? The drawings of Abbott and Costello, the caricatures. Well, I looked at this one and I was prepared to feel the same way. And I thought, no, these are kind of fun. They're actually doing stuff. You know, when the lighting titles come up, you see a light fall or whatever. You know, the producer is sweating and pulling out his hair. The director is yelling at them, whatever. It's just a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So it's got a great cast. We've got a wonderful cast, but we'll get to them as we go. So the movie opens, and one of my all-time, and I'm sorry, but in a fairly minor Abbott and Costello film, it has one of the best openings they've ever had. Not only one of the best, but the cleverest and the most satirical.
Neath a merciless sun, across the trackless desert, march the men of the Foreign Legion. Unwanted men, the forsaken of 100 nations. They came to the Legion to forget. Our story is about 2 men whom the Foreign Legion would like to forget. And they were unwanted, even in Brooklyn.
By the way, for those of you movie buffs, and especially for Universal Studios fans, that narration was done by Jeff Chandler, the famous actor with the, you know, the gray hair. He looks like Spider-Man's editor.
Yeah.
And just between us, Esther Williams, in her autobiography, which was really, nobody liked her afterwards because she really blew the whistle on everybody, including Jeff Chandler, who nobody knew this until she opened her mouth, and now I'm going to do it. He was a cross-dresser. She was dating him, and one day she was up in his room and opened the closet, and he had more dresses than she did. But not as many bathing suits. So she got in her car and carpooled. So anyway, that was... it's actually very intelligent stuff. Even though it's wrapped in slapstick wrapping, it's really intelligent. And if you're one of those people that just shakes your head when you hear people talk about professional wrestling and how it must be real, it's got to be real. Well, it's not. And they take it to town on this one. This is just so much fun. It starts out where these two wrestlers, Wee Willie Davis, and he's fighting Sam Maneker. He's an ex-wrestler. And the two of them are working on, and, you know, and you hear the crowd screaming and yelling, and they're wrestling, and Bud is the referee, and he's got his derby on. And finally, you know, Bud says, "Stop it, stop," right? "You guys are stinking up my script." He's holding the script. "You're smelling it up." And he tells Lou, "Quiet that audience." And Lou turns around and says, "Quiet, quiet." And we see it's a recording of a crowd. So he takes the record off and smashes it and says, "That'll keep you quiet." So I just love this scene. Bud asks Lou to help out. Right. So Lou is getting into the ring and he trips, and the ropes are literally choking him to death, and his tongue is out, and he's around, and Bud's talking to the two wrestlers and saying, "Look, look at that face. That's what I want. You see the suffering, you know," and as Lou's like, you know, dying. So anyway, that's how the sketch goes pretty much. Every time, you know, Bud suggests something, the wrestler will take Lou and just turn him into a pretzel or throw him into the air or whatever it is. All I know is I hope his stuntmen got a lot of money that day. Because there are some terrific falls. My favorite being when they decide they have to flip a coin. And Wee Willie Davis says, "Ah, the hell with that." And he picks up Lou and flips him. He throws him in the air and flips him. It's really, this whole scene is worth the price of admission alone. It's just fantastic. So
this segment itself would have made a good Castle film.
Oh, you
know, I don't know if they ever released this part, but that would have been, I would have bought that. Yeah.
Well, I had the Castle film and it was just called Foreign Legion.
Yeah.
And it begins with the massacre.
Okay.
And then goes to the wrestling in the tent and then the big chase and the thing blowing up.
Yep.
But anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about Wee Willie Davis. Wee Willie Davis, born in New York City in 1906, same year as Blue, passed away in 1981 at the age of 74. He was 6'5", 290 pounds. That's a big fella. Not only was he a wrestler, a professional wrestler from the age of 24, but he was an inventor. He was an engineer. And he and another guy invented something called the glow meter. And basically, it would, when you pressed a button, it would project the speed you were going in your car right on your windshield. It didn't take off, but they had a patent and the whole bit. He invented it. Pretty cool. Everybody thinks, you know, big dumb guy. He made a lot of movies. My favorite being, I think it was called Bowery Bombshell. with the Bowery Boys. Mm-hmm. And in this one, he accidentally swallows an explosive. And they put pillows on his feet so he doesn't blow them. It's very funny. But Wee Willie was in a lot of movies, always as a wrestler or a gorilla, you know, a big guy. And he finished up his career as a gymnasium guard at the Jefferson County Jail in Louisville, Kentucky, from 1972 to 1975. And he passed away there in Louisville. So there he was. There's Wee Willie Davis. And he is a formidable fellow, for sure. So that whole scene is just classic. I will say it. It's classic. Classic Abbott and Costello. And again, Bud is just as present as Lou. And mm-hmm. I just wish there was more of that. That's my only complaint. Yeah. Okay.
I have to say, last episode you had commented about how dapper Bud looks in a derby. And so when this film opens and there he is with the derby, I thought, gosh, maybe they heard Nick. And quite honestly, you know, looking ahead a little bit, the next film, he spends most of the time in a derby. So it was a style that worked well for him.
Yes, I agree. I agree. And it's funny about them because, you know, Laurel and Hardy are so iconic as far as their costumes, right? Yeah. They seldom changed and they always wear the same hats. Mm-hmm. But Bud and Lou, I always think of Bud in the fedora, right? Turned down. Yep. Yep. Almost gangster-like, and Lou in a fedora turned up with the brim turned up. But he eventually opted for the little derby he wore in burlesque.
Yes.
And I know Matthew Conium's not crazy about that. He feels like it was part of the beginning of the end.
Yeah.
But I think he looks cute in it. You know, he's got that little hat. It's a little too small.
Yes. Know? Yes.
But it's okay. It's okay. So anyway, here's what happens. They do this great scene. And Abdul, Wee Willie Davis, he was imported from Algeria. And Bud and Lou had to borrow $5,000 from a local gangster to have him shipped over here so he could, you know, win matches and make them a lot of money. So what happens is he decides, and I'm talking about Abdul, he doesn't want to lose. I'm the greatest wrestler in the world. And he leaves. He goes back to Algeria. So Bud and Lou, what are we going to do? You know, we borrowed $5,000. It's gone, blah, blah, blah. And sure enough, right behind them is our friend Mark Lawrence.
Yes.
Looking very mean and very, you know, set upon to kill them. Mm-hmm. With his pockmarked face and turned down fedora. But he's Frankie. That's all we hear. That's his name, Frankie. And he threatens them. Either you get him back here or I'll kill you. And Bud says, how about if we just try and raise the 5,000 and get that to you? He goes, no, this isn't about 5,000. This is about getting this wrestler here so we could make lots of thousands. So go get him. So that's what they have to do. They have to go to Algeria. And within a second in this film, this is Charles Lamont, within a second, they are in Algeria. Yeah. There's no map showing them going. There's no, you know, whatever. So the boys are suddenly in Algeria and they look great. They're wearing white suits and their pith helmets. And it's just so funny that, think about it. They would have to buy the tickets. They would have to pack, get on the ship, probably take a good week or two on the ocean, get to Algeria, and then start looking around. That's when Lou turns to Bud and says, why are we here? It reminds me of those old gangster movies where they pull up in front of the bank and the guy says, so what do we do, boss? Didn't you plan this?
Yeah.
Oh, it's funny. So they're in Algeria. They're looking around. And I just wanted to bring this up for one second because my sensitive nature, you know, compels me.
Yeah.
There was a thing where Lou sees a beautiful girl and he follows her. And he's getting ready to flirt with her and possibly steal a kiss. And he turns around. And in the time that he turns around, the pretty girl has been replaced by a fat, ugly woman. And Lou turns around and goes, you know, and recoils. And that's the joke. And I just thought to myself, That poor woman. The line follows.
I think she's either a very ugly girl or a very pretty monster.
Yeah. And I'm thinking of this poor woman.
Yep, you know? Yep.
What was the casting notice? You know, monstrously ugly women wanted, you know, for a cruel joke.
Yes.
And it is cruel. So he ends up getting back to the pretty girl, and he's caught kissing her. And every time he's caught kissing one of these lovely, like harem girls, he pulls away and he's got one of their veils in his mouth. And that's the dead giveaway that he's been a bad boy. So that's the first time. And it becomes a running gag throughout the movie. And it's kind of cute. Mm-hmm. So anyway, they're walking around. They're blah, blah, blah. They're looking. And they are attacked, pretty much. People think they are spies. Now, the people that think they are spies are our villains. Okay? We get a look at not only Douglas Dumbrill, who is the gold standard of villains, mm-hmm. but we have another one of my favorites. Not only Dan Seymour, who's there as well, but Walter Slezak.
Yes.
How many Walter Slezak people are out there? I'm a big Woo-hoo! Fan. Yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. Film noir out the wazoo.
Yep.
And believe it or not, he was a very handsome leading man. He was born in Austria, in Vienna, in 1902. He was the son of an opera star, Leo Slezak. In fact, Walter's autobiography is called What Time is the Next Swan? And it's based on a quote from his dad, who was doing opera, and he was supposed to make his exit on this, you know, mechanical swan, and the swan left before he was finished with his aria. And he turned to the audience and said, "What time is the next swan?" So that became the name of Walter's book, which is just fabulous. He studied medicine at first. He worked in a bank for a while. And then his good friend, Michael Curtiz, probably one of the top three directors of all time, mm-hmm. Talked him into doing a film in 1922. He was good looking. He was blonde. He had wavy hair. The movie was called Sodom and Gomorrah. The other comedy team that I like.
yeah, loved him, hated her, yeah.
But he did leads in silent films in his native country, went to America and debuted on Broadway in 1931. His first American film was way later in 1942, a movie called Once Upon a Honeymoon, where he was the villainous Nazi against Cary Grant and Ginger Rogers. And it's a terrible movie. It doesn't know what it wants to be. It's a comedy. It's a wartime drama. Mm. It's a tragedy. It's I don't know. Yeah. It's boring. So anyway, he did some really, really fine work in film noir. Cornered. I love Cornered with Dick Powell. He was in The Inspector General with mm-hmm. Danny Kaye. He was the Clock King on Batman.
Yes!
He did Batman! And he did operettas at the Met in New York. His last movie was Black Beauty in 1971. He was married in 1943, had three kids. His daughter, Erica Slezak, was on One Life to Live for 41 years.
Wow.
Talk about a gig.
Yeah.
And Walter appeared on it in 1974 as her godfather, Laszlo Breidecker. Huh. So he did that. Unfortunately, our pal in 1983, at the age of 80, he committed suicide, but with a gun to the head. Mm. He was very depressed, very ill, and he just wanted to get out fast. And he did. Mm-hmm. So bless you, Walter Slezak. Thanks for all the great performances. But he is our main villain here, and he is the traitor, the traitorous Axeman. Commander, yes. Axeman.
Yeah.
And what a great name, Axeman. Mm-hmm. And it's two N's, like he's a Nazi. It's a German, you know, it's a German mm-hmm. Spelling. So they're planning. Bud and Lou don't know anything yet, but they're saying that these two guys now, these two American strangers, we got to take care of them, but do it carefully, you know, take them into an alley, get rid of them, blah, blah, blah. So they send their toughs, they're knife wielding Arabs mm-hmm. To go after Bud and Lou. So Bud decides he's going to go into the embassy and talk to somebody. It's one of those things. I'm going to go inside. You sit here and do funny stuff. So Lou sits down on the bench. He's really tired. And these three lugs sit down next to him. And I mean close next to him, threatening him with knives. And one of them is Harry Wilson, of course, our buddy from all the other movies, the ugly guy. And every time Lou, you know, makes a move, they make a move. It's just, you know, whatever. And finally, he outwits them. He loses them. And it's, you know, he has to run around. He has to hide, blah, blah, blah. He's totally out of breath, totally tired. He sits down again on the bench. And Bud comes out at that moment and says, "What are you resting for? Get up. Come on. We got things to do. You're always sitting around." So Lou has to get up again. So anyway, the two of them are now being chased. And I don't mean chased like innocent. I mean, they are chased. And so what they do is they see parade of foreign legionnaires marching, and they figure we'll be very safe with these people. So they get in line and they're marching along with the boys. And they end up hiding in the commandant's office. The commandant, Mr. Axeman, tricks them into signing up for 5 years in the Foreign Legion. Now, I really like the thing where they find out and, you know, they're saying goodbye. Thank you very much. And he's like, okay, welcome to the Legion, you know, blah, blah, blah. They go out, they close the door, and then there's a beat, and then they explode through the door. And here's another Bud thing I wanted to talk about. They were both supposed to say Foreign Legion, right? Only Lou says it. Bud's about to say it, but he stops. And I don't know why. It's a very awkward moment, you know? Yeah. And it's like, Bud, come on. And that was my complaint about Meet the Killer. It's like, why wasn't Bud in the finale? The two of them should be working together. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this is why, you know, Laurel and Hardy are more appreciated today, because they were always working together.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, they are now in the Foreign Legion, and they immediately have to start training. This is one of my favorite scenes. This is where Lou has to use the bayonet, you know, whatever. Now, did you see where he takes the bayonet? There are dummies hanging. They don't have a head. They, you know, they don't have hands or feet, but they have legs, they have arms, and they're hanging there, and you're supposed to stick your bayonet into them. Lou sticks it right between his legs and keeps it there while he's doing other shtick. And I'm thinking to myself, where is Breen? Where are the censors? You know, it's like so obvious what he's doing. Nobody says anything. No one does anything.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's some funny stuff going on there. One of my favorite things is when the dummy falls and he has to pick it up to hook it back onto the thing it was hanging on. Mm-hmm. And Walter Slezak walks up, almost taking the place. And Lou doesn't realize it. He's trying to lift Walter Slezak onto the hook. And it's very funny. The other thing he does that I absolutely love is when they're doing crawling under the barbed wire.
Yes. Right?
So they're all on their stomachs and they're all going and blah, blah, blah. Lou is off to the side, just walking it and watching everybody work. He's just walking, you know, oh, this is easy. This is great.
Yeah.
The funny thing is that was not in the script. Lou improvised that, and it became one of the funniest things in the movie.
Oh, yeah. That, and you've got the whole time Bud is, you know, come on, Lou, come on, I'll help you. Let's go. And he doesn't even realize that he's not behind him. Yeah.
And then Lou's helping him at the end, you know.
Yes.
Helping him out. It was funny stuff. The whole training thing is very funny. So anyway, they're called into the office of the real commander, the one who's not a traitor.
Yeah.
For some reason, I don't know why, maybe because they speak English, they are given the job of going to find out, you know, who the traitors are, who the leak is, where it is. So they tell them to go to the specific address, 82 Rue Lafayette.
Yep.
And Axeman actually gives them the wrong address. He tells them 282. Now, this is where we go into our first French lesson. We? So we're going? We. Oh, you're going too? No, just you. We? Yes. Us? No, we. Us. Right? So it goes on like that. This is our John Grant stuff. And at least Bud's involved here, which is nice.
Yep.
And they're sent off on their way. And this comes back again, but not with Bud, with Patricia Medina, which is very cute. It's very funny. So anyway, they're off at night to do this secret mission. And they go to 282 Rue Lafayette. And it turns out to be where Patricia Medina is. Now, who is Patricia Medina? In this movie, she's Nicole Dupre from French Intelligence. And she's trying to get Bud and Lou to help her trap Axeman and Douglas DeMille and, you know, all the bad guys. And boy, are they bad in this movie. Let me tell you. Patricia Medina, in an interview, said that she had the time of her life dealing with the boys, especially Lou. She said that she was warned by everybody, just like Hillary Brooke. She was warned by everybody. What are you doing? They never give you a cue. They're going to throw a pie at you. Blah, 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 all this stuff. And she was nervous on the first day and then fell right into it and had the time of her life. So I'm so happy to hear that because she works really well with them. And you could see she's having a good time. So I always love that. So Patricia Medina, born in 1919 in Liverpool, England. Her father, Laureano Ramon Medina Nibo. That's his name.
Okay.
Mom is Edith May Strode from England. She started quite the contrast there.
Yeah.
Right. The only married couple I know that needed an interpreter. She started acting as a teenager in the late 1930s. By the mid 40s, she was playing leads on stage in England. She moved to Hollywood in the mid 40s. She was teamed up with the actor Lewis Hayward in four films, starting in 1950, this year. The Fortunes of Captain Blood. It was a sequel to Captain Blood, which I grew up on. I watched it every time it was on, mostly because Donna Drake is in it, and I'm in love with her. So anyway, she made a lot of movies. There was another one I liked that she did called The Fighting O'Flynn, RKO, late 40s. She's great, and she's so pretty.
Yes.
She was married to another pretty person, Richard Green, the leading man, British leading man, who had the contract at Fox, eventually became Robin Hood on television. They were married for 10 years in 1941 to 1951. So she was still married to him while they were making this movie. And then they divorced and she ended up marrying Joseph Cotten,
yeah,
in 1960. Like 9 years later. So she was single. I mean, I would have dated her. So, she did a lot of television. You know, she did four episodes of Zorro for Disney. She did Rawhide, Burke's Law, you name it, everything. Her last movie was The Killing of Sister George in 1968, a lesbian drama. Her last film, this is what I'm fascinated by, and this is me in a nutshell, and I mean nutshell. She made a movie called Timber Tramps in 1975, and it was one of those independent, horrible movies that probably didn't get wide release, and it starred Claude Akins, Leon Ames from Meet Me in St. Louis, Cesar Romero, Joseph Cotten, and Patricia Medina. I swear to God.
Oh, my gosh.
Never heard of it, never saw it.
No. But
you can bet I'm going to be looking for it. So anyway, she had a great career, a great marriage, and she passed away in 2012 at the age of 92.
Wow.
So way to go, Patricia. And she teams up with the boys here. They have to do some spy work. Actually, where they first meet Patricia Medina is at the slave auction. They do run into her at the harem where they're not supposed to be. And, you know, she warns them to get out. They'll be killed if they're found, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, she's part of the slave girl auction. She's going to be auctioned off by a guy by the name of Leon Belasco. Now,
yes.
I'm a big Leon Belasco fan. I know that seems unusual, but I really enjoy him. In fact, I enjoy him so much that when I was a little kid, I used to confuse him with another one of my favorite character people, Sig Arno. So I'm going to give you those two names to look up on Google, Leon Belasco and Sig Arno. And the two of them are just, you know, they played kind of the same kind of parts. But anyway, and they were both little and, you know, had accents. Anyway, Leon was born Leonid Semenovich Berlasky in Odessa, Russia in 1902. He attended St. Joseph's College in Yokohama, Japan. He was briefly the conductor of the Japanese-Russian Symphony Orchestra. He moved to Hollywood in 1921, didn't make his film debut until 1926, a movie called The Best People. He played violin like a virtuoso, and he had his own orchestra, jazz orchestra. He was the guy who discovered, ready, the Andrews Sisters. He gave them their first exposure. Eventually, he made many movies, just a few names you probably never heard of, Holiday Inn, Yankee Doodle Dandy, Casablanca, Road to Morocco, Never Give a Sucker an Even Break, Nothing But the Truth, The Heat's On, Mae West's last vintage film, See My Lawyer with Olsen and Johnson, Swing Parade of 1946 with the Three Stooges, with a stroke Curly. It's really tough to watch. And his final film, just like a lot of them, Juan Ton Ton, The Dog Who Saved Hollywood, in 1976. But the movie I love most of all is Playmates from 1941, John Barrymore's last movie. He plays Prince Uruhu. Uruhu.
Sure.
Oh, John Barrymore has so much fun with that name in this movie. But he plays a fake, you know, fortune teller, and he's very good. So anyway, that's our friend Leon. Passed away in 1988 at the age of 85. Way to go, Leon. So Leon's doing the slave auction, and he's putting in the Lucky Strike cigarettes auctioneer. Sold to the American. So Lou is standing in the crowd watching all the beautiful girls, and across the way is Douglas Dumbrill, who wants to buy all of these women. So he's sitting there, and the way they are bidding is it's almost like a wave of the hand. You know, if you're going to hold up your hand and just point your fingers up and down like you're waving bye-bye, 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 that's how you bid. Now, Lou sees him doing this and thinks he's waving to him, of course. And I love what Matthew says here in his chapter. He says, yes, if it were anyone else, it would be the same joke over and over and over again. Lou, being a great mime, a great physical comedian, and a great improviser, does it differently every time. He gives a different wave, almost like a different motivation for each wave. And it's great. It's just great. And it's funny. It ends up he wins the bidding for 160,000 kolaks or whatever it is. And kolaks. And so he has to pay. And of course, Leon comes up, where's my money? And they're saying, we don't have it, blah, blah, blah. So they're on the run. And that's where they team up with Patricia Medina. And the three of them are a unit at this point. So this is where they're told they have to go search Walter Slezak's place because they're suspecting him of being the traitor. In fact, they're sure of it. They just need proof. So the two of them find out when he's not going to be there, and they go to his place and they start looking around. Finally, they find a piece of paper with Arabic writing on it. And Bud says, this is it. This is it. We've got him. All we have to do is get someone to translate this, and we've got him. Oh, I can't wait to see his face. And of course, he's standing behind them. I think they do this in every movie.
Yeah.
Boy, if I could see him, I'd punch him right in the face. About that. And oh, hello. So that's what this is. And he's about to probably kill them. When they're saved at the last minute, they have to go and replace, or at least fortify, a troop of foreign legionnaires who are under attack or are about to be under attack. So he's got to get everybody together, including Bud and Lou, and now they are in it. They are in the desert. They are marching. This is it. This is the foreign legion, damn it. I think this is the most commented upon by the critics at the time, and the audience loved this. The mirage sequences.
Yes.
Oh, by the way, this was also in the Castle films, the mirages.
Okay.
Yeah, I had the long one, you know, the 8-minute one or 7-minute one. So anyway, can you imagine 7 minutes out of an 80-minute movie, you know? And we were happy to have it.
Oh, yeah.
You hear that, kids? We were happy to have it. I used to watch it while I was walking to school in the snow uphill. So anyway, they are on the desert at this point. And I just want to point out, if you're sharp-eyed and you have the Blu-ray, you see the seams in the background, in the scenery in the background. Not an unusual thing in those days, but it's pretty obvious in this one. And I have to mention that Ed Wood Jr., the great Plan 9 from Outer Space filmmaker, actually worked on this film and worked at Universal very briefly as a production assistant. And we're told that he was so impressed by the amount of sand Universal transported to this set, he talked about it for the rest of his life. When you look at it, it's like, really? That's what he was talking about? Anyway, it reminds me of Lost in Alaska. You know, they're how cheap it looks, you know. And you also see the seams in that one, too, as well. So it seems. So anyway, they are walking in the desert. They lose their troop. What happens is, and this is so funny, they're sitting with the soldiers that Douglas Dumbrill and his nasty Arabs are about to slaughter, I mean massacre, everyone. And Bud and Lou are part of this. They're part of that troop. But they are off to the side, and Lou is counting ammunition. He's counting bullets because the commandant told him to check the ammunition. So he's counting the bullets. Bud is cleaning his gun in the meantime, and he's not looking at Lou. He's just talking about his family and their careers in the military. And yeah, I bought this.
I got hip to this army life back in 1945.
45, 46, 1947, 1948.
My father, he was hip to it in 1917.
1917, 1918, 1920, 1921.
The uncle. The guy was contented. He was happy. He was a rough rider in 98.
98, 99, 100.
My grandfather. He was a drummer boy in 61.
61, 62, 63, 64.
Even if that girl did get our message, our chances of getting out of here would be 100 to 1.
101. 102, 103, 104, an axeman, 5.
As a wise guy, brings us into this outfit for 5 years.
5! 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
And I'll find a way out. I'm a pretty smart cookie, too.
2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
What are you doing?
7, 8. The captain told me to check the ammunition.
That doesn't mean to count each bullet. Put it back.
So what happens is they scare one of the camels. Sally the camel runs off, and they feel like, oh my God, we're going to get in trouble. Let's go find her. So the two of them leave to find Sally, and that's when the attack happens after they're gone. So everyone except Bud and Lou and Walter Slezak are killed. It's quite a shocking scene, in fact. They're sleeping. And these people come in and they're just like hacking them with the swords. It's really rough. It's rough stuff. This is where I draw the line with Matthew Conium, who thinks these are all for children now. That's not for children. But anyway, I understand what he's saying, but I don't agree 100%. So anyway, Bud and Lou are on their own. And that's when they start seeing the mirages. Now, first, Lou sees a skeleton all broken up, you know, at his feet on the sand, and he turns around and then he turns back and the skeleton is all put together and he's standing there talking to Lou. And he has a voice like this, very, you know, deep. It turns out that's Candy Candido. And you wonder, did Bud meet Candy during this? But the truth of the matter is Candy only dubbed this in the Foley booth. I'm sure they never met.
Yeah.
In fact, this fact I found interesting. All the noises you hear when Lou is in long shot, all the, you know, all that stuff, you know, all the screaming and all that stuff, it's all from earlier films, because right after this film was finished shooting, they had to go to Europe to work the Palladium and, you know, the British Isles and for the soldiers. And they didn't do any dubbing. They couldn't. They didn't have any time. So you'll hear a lot of familiar Loo noises. You also hear a lot of familiar Frankenstein music in this movie.
Oh, and yes.
We're going to hear that for the rest of their careers. That's how good that score is. And it fits, you know, if you've got something creepy, Frankenstein. So they are off and they do one of my favorite gags. And that is where Lou is all of a sudden hears a newspaper guy.
It's the New York Daily Record right here. X-ray, read on about the water shortage. X-ray, get your daily record right here. X-ray.
Hey, boy, what are you doing way out here?
Can I help it if they gave me a bad corner?
X-ray.
And he disappears. And it was one of the biggest laughs in the preview. And it still gets laughs today. Mm-hmm. They repeat it with Bobby Barber in the TV show. Dead End Kid, David Gorcey, Leo's brother, Bernard's son. I'm a friend of the Gorcey family. And poor David. David played Chuck in the Bowery Boys movies. Mm-hmm. And if he was lucky, he'd get like maybe one line or maybe two, you know, but he was always in the background, always doing his best, always reacting. But unfortunately, he had the curse. He became a hopeless alcoholic, ended up on Skid Row and living in a cheap motel eventually. And eventually he got a cheap apartment and he started like finding God and helping other people, you know, having this problem, which is good. So he sort of redeemed himself towards the end. And anyway, that's David Gorcey. Poor man. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's a very funny gag. I'm sorry to ruin it with that story. I'm one of those people who's like, oh, we had a great Christmas. Other than Aunt Ethel, who was hit by a plane as she was walking towards the front door. So anyway, that's dark. So they eventually do. Well, Lou is fooled again by a soda fountain in the middle of the desert. This is all stuff that was done in Road to Morocco, by the way. But anyway, Lou runs towards the soda fountain. He's about to get the ice cream soda, and of course it disappears. One of the women there in the bathing suit is Anne Robinson from War of the Worlds and other movies at Universal, mm-hmm. Redhead. I met her at a screening of War of the Worlds at Paramount. I have a really sweet picture of the two of us. And about 2 months later, I ended up calling her a very bad name and unfriending her on Facebook and blocking her because she's a racist and a Trumper. And I don't mind that she's a Trumper. She can believe whatever she wants. That's her right. She's an American, but she's also a racist. So anyway, I don't like that woman. The boys eventually hit on a real Oasis. And this is my favorite scene other than the wrestling scene, is the fish with Liberace teeth. Before the boys get to the Oasis, one of the Arab guys who's there is washing his face or something in the pond, and his false teeth fall out into the water. And this fish comes up, and he's got the teeth in his mouth. And he chomps, chomp, chomp. You know, it's very funny, and it's a very funny effect. Every time he comes up and chomps, it's a laugh. It's a solid laugh. So, of course, when they go and they start fishing, Bud is catching all these little fish, you know, normally ones you would throw away. You would throw back in. They're so small. But he would hand them to Lou and say, here, put this aside. We'll eat this. We'll eat this. And he keeps handing them fish. And Lou is using it to attract the fish with the teeth, who keeps coming up and biting the fish in half. And of course, the final scene, you know, Lou looks down and is about to hit him, and the fish squirts him in the face with the water. So it's, in a way, it's the frog in the soup. It's the oyster in the soup. It's, you know, whatever. But it's a variation, and it's a very clever variation. Mm-hmm. So I like it very, very much. So anyway, they get captured, and they end up at Douglas Dumbrill's tent with all of his tribe. And eventually, Patricia Medina is captured and brought there. And so is Walter Slezak. He's not captured, but he's there because he's the one left living, and he's the one there. Basically, let me explain this. This all has to do with the railroad. I'm skipping the plot of the movie because it's just so lame. What they're doing is they're discouraging the railroad from going through where they plan on going through. And eventually they're killing enough people that the railroad will have to listen to them for their terms and pay them money and all this stuff. So that's what they're trying to do. That's why they're killing everybody.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, while they're there under the tent, they have their own little, I think of Road to Morocco. I can't help it. It's kind of like the same thing, only with reefers. remember Hope catches Crosby making these little cigarettes and he goes, what are you doing, rolling reefers? But anyway, they do the same thing. They create havoc. They realize that Abdullah, Wee Willie Davis, is the cousin of Douglas Dumbrill and is there that day for the entertainment as a wrestler. And who is the other wrestler but our pal Tor Johnson, who Ed Wood might have met right there on the set.
Highly possible.
I think, I'd say it's pretty probable.
Yeah.
So anyway, their plan is to have Wee Willie Davis, 6'5", 290, and Tor Johnson, who is probably, 5'11", 800 pounds. And they're going to twist Bud and Lou into pretzels and kill them, basically. But Wee Willie Davis, Abdullah, is tired of his cousin. He doesn't like his cousin, and he wants out. He wants to get back to Brooklyn with the boys. So they decide to use the Patterson routine. Lou uses any excuse to get his hometown mentioned in every single filmed appearance. So they use the Patterson routine. And then eventually the Boston routine, which is, this was censored, by the way. It was supposed to be eye pokes like the Stooges. But the censor said, no, you can't do that. Kids will do that. They'll imitate it. I don't suppose he ever went to a Three Stooges film. Now, Tommy, stop hitting your brother with the wrench. So anyway, they do the Boston routine. And this is basically they put their hand flat over the bridge of their nose and slap it with the other hand. And it works. It looks good. And eventually, everybody's doing it. And they do it to Wee Willie Davis, and he's like, I'm blind. I can't see. And, of course, he starts attacking Tor Johnson, and all hell breaks loose, and everybody's using the Boston routine. And finally, there's a big pylon, Bud and Lou. All the Arabs are on top. Douglas Dumbrill comes over and says, get off of them. Get on, let me have them. I'm going to kill them. He pulls them off, and there they are, and he picks them up, and it's two Arabs dressed as Bud and Lou, and Bud and Lou are wearing the Arabs' clothes. Only in comedies, ladies and gentlemen, only in comedies. So Patricia Medina is dressed as a slave girl. The boys are dressed as Arabs. Wee Willie is already dressed as Arabs. So what do? They try to escape. And they get in Walter Slezak's Jeep, and they drive away. So Slezak and everybody else gets on their horses, and the chase is on. And it's kind of like Ride 'Em Cowboy. With the Jeep going forward and then backward and passing them and, whatever.
Yep.
It's a good chase. It really is a lot of fun. And again, this was the finale to the Castle film as well. Okay, I'm going to bring up my problem with this now. And this bothered me when I was a kid, and it bothers me now. And to me, it's thoughtless filmmaking. This is the finale. Slezak and the Arabs have the fort wired to explode. To kill everybody, all the legionnaires. Bud and Lou get there first, with the Jeep and with the Patricia Medina and everybody, and they see the Arabs are coming, right? But then on the other side, the Foreign Legion is coming as well, because they have to go to the fort. But Bud and Lou are dressed as Arabs, so they're getting shot at by both teams, their own team and, Slezak's team. So they're lost. They go into the fort. They close the door. And finally, Bud says, you hold them, Lou. We'll go. I have to take Wee Willie with me. I need him. Okay. So we leave little Lou to put his arm through where the latch would go. And, of course, everybody on their horses went into the fort. So Bud and Lou close them in. And Lou is locking them in, but they're trying to get out, and they're using a battering ram. And of course, it almost hits Lou three times. And Bud and Wee Willie and Patricia Medina are almost a mile away watching this whole thing. And Bud accidentally trips the detonator and blows up the fort. And I mean, there's nothing left of it. It just, no one could live through it. What about those poor horses? Everybody was on a horse, an innocent horse. And see, to me, that's just sloppy filmmaking. They should have gotten to a point where they were fighting them. They get off the horses, their sword play and all that. They run into the place and good, blow them up, but don't blow up those horses. So that always was a sore point with me. And that takes one star away or maybe half a star. Okay. So they win. That's it. They get rid of all the villains. Everybody's blown up and they're at a medal ceremony. We're going to get a citation. What do I want with a racehorse?
If yes. I may, let's mention what happens after the fort gets blown up.
A gag that they had used in Africa Screams recently. They used it in Abbott and Costello in Hollywood. I think they use it again later on. I'm not sure, but this is the Bud thinks he killed Lou. Oh, I've always treated him badly, and oh, I'm the poor little guy, and about and Lou comes up behind him, and he turns around. Why, you double crosser? And gives him a good slap across the face. In fact, there are three slaps in this one. It's getting to the point where you can count them, you know, on one hand, so to speak.
I have to say, yes, they did it a few times, but for some reason, this bit always cracks me up.
Oh, it's a great bit. It really
always. Is.
Even when they do it on their television shows and all that stuff.
Yes.
It's a perfect thing for Bud, especially, you know?
Yeah.
He gets to really play and act up and ham up. It's great. That's what Bud does best. Yeah. So, so they use that there and that ends that scene. And then eventually, you know, the French guy gives Lou a medal and gives him a kiss on either cheek. And Lou looks like he looks really shy, his little boy shy face. Anyway, so the ending basically is the commandant tells them to get the hell out of Egypt or Algeria, go home. There's a boat leaving in 20 minutes. Be on it. So they go to the Jeep and Lou says, you know what? I think I'll ride in the trailer. And Bud's like, trailer? And he goes in the back. Lou is already halfway in and he pulls Lou out. And opens up the trailer. He reveals what's in it. And it's like six slave girls. And, you know, of course, Lou has the veil coming out of his mouth, just like through the entire movie. But in this case, he starts pulling it out. And it's like 20 feet of handkerchiefs. It just keeps coming and coming and coming. And it fades out as he's looking at us like, whoa. So that is the end of Abbott and Costello in the Foreign Legion. And I have to say, it's a movie I really like. I know a lot of people are saying 1950 was where the decline started. And I will agree with you. I do think that the movies were not as good as the 1940s movies. But I won't say that there aren't some gems. In fact, our next episode is as good as any movie they ever made. And this is, what, 1951 that's coming out? So let's get ready for that one. So, Jerry, what is your assessment at this point now? I've been doing all the yapping, and I'd love to hear what you think.
Well, you know, if I could yap with half the authority and facts that you do, then I'd be happy.
Then buy a fax machine.
Well, there you are. And I always feel like I'm just being a yes man, but I agree with you completely on this assessment as well. It's not their best by any means, but it's a good, entertaining movie. It's a good, solid entry into their filmography. And honestly, especially with comedy for some reason, a comedy team will have their early days, their growth, they hit the heights, and then it will change. It has to.
Right.
Because comedy is so subjective, cultural tastes change. You either have to adapt with that or keep doing what you've been doing and no longer be popular.
That's right.
And so it happens that things change.
Right.
And yes, the 50s, that's when it started to change for Bud and Lou. But as you say, there's still some really good ones. And I would put this one in the very good category.
Yeah, I think it's a very good movie. I agree with you. It's just, how can you put it? It's not one of the ones that says, oh, yeah, In the Foreign Legion, that's my favorite. You know, it's not going to be that movie.
Yeah.
But I remember as a kid on Sunday mornings, when that one would come up in the rotation, I was always happy. I always enjoyed it. I'm going to bring up the one scene, though, that drives me absolutely crazy. And I didn't like it when I was a kid, and I don't like it now.
Okay.
And if you're a Bud lover like I am, it's not easy to watch. The scene where he totally cowards out when Lou is stuck on the machine gun. Lou is like stuck on it. He doesn't know how to work it. And it's just, he's shooting up the entire fort. And Bud immediately, oh, they're surrounding us. They're going to kill us all. Ah! And he grabs a white flag and he's ready to surrender and all this stuff while everyone else is like getting ready to fight back. And, you know, but Bud, no, he's out there showing what a lily-livered coward he is.
Yeah.
And even to the point where he runs through the door to get away. And apparently Bud got hurt doing that. And I don't like that scene. I just don't like that scene. It's just Bud is constantly, it seems, put in these situations where his character is held up, you know, to a mirror, and it's not always good. You know what yeah. I mean? Like in Africa Screams, he's sort of a villain, you know, or some of the others where he's just not on the up and up or mm-hmm. whatever. In this one, they didn't need that. Why didn't Bud go over to the gun itself and get his finger caught and the two of them try to work it out together? That's just a black mark for me, you know?
Yeah.
And I also made me think of, and I don't know if you saw this when you were a kid, but I went to see McHale's Navy Joins the Air Force in the movie.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. And I think it was a double bill with Birds Do It with Soupy Sales. But my point is, Tim Conway in that movie, in the McHale's Navy movie, does the exact same thing. He gets mm-hmm. caught on the gun and he's shooting everything up and he can't stop. So see, Abbott and Costello inspired people 20 years later, you know, or 15 yeah. years later. So anyway, that was my my one black mark about that movie. You won't find a better cast. Again, Slezak is just worth his weight in gold, and that's a lot of weight.
Yeah.
You know? And if you're really into it, check out some of his film noir roles. He's a great film noir villain. It just seemed like fat people were villainous back then. You know? Mm. Laird Krieger, Sidney Greenstreet, Walter Slezak. I don't know what that is, but maybe it's because they seem overindulgent. You know, which is a sin to normal people, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, this was a lot of fun. As usual, Jerry, I hate that it's finished. Yeah. And I hope we're inspiring people to watch the film. Some people already have. I've been hearing from people, in fact, a lot this week, and they are loving this podcast. They are really enjoying our podcast. And they're learning things, and they teach me things. They write to me all the time. My only thing is, guys, you know, we're getting like in our last podcast, we're almost up to like 700 views. So that should be 700 subscriptions. You should be hitting subscribe. You should be hitting like. Otherwise, to tell you the truth, if we don't have the numbers, if you guys aren't helping us stay here, I'm going to end it. I'm going to have to, you know, I hate to be Trump-like, but ratings count in this kind of thing. And we need your help. Don't just listen to it or listen to half of it or whatever it is and just click it off. Please subscribe and like. Or else go to any one of the other podcast platforms and you'll find us there waiting for you. Okay? So enjoy the boys. Enjoy the Foreign Legion. And Jerry, as usual, it's always a pleasure and the highlight of these 2 weeks.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way. I have to concur. I have to concur, so I better go.
Okay.
I really have to concur right now.
Chili concur. Deborah concur. Yeah, okay. Well, I'm glad you do concur. I'm glad you have a good time. And I have to tell you, folks, that he is amazing. We do this, and we stop and go. There are times we have to stop and go. Jerry takes this and turns it into something. He turns it into something that you enjoy. So kudos to Jerry. And kudos to all of our listeners and fans. Thank you so much for listening. And we will see you next time with one of my favorite Abbott and Costello movies of all time, Meet the Invisible Man. So we will not see you then.
You?
We.
Oh, then you had somebody help you.
No, I arranged it.
That's what I said. You did.
We.
Yes, you had somebody help you.
No, we, O-U-I means yes.
What does I-O-U mean? No?
Shut up.